and welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later.
If the rich, if the elites, if the big companies are obviously not meeting their fair share, why should I? And, you know, why should I be the only mug who pays tax? And it erodes all the way down, and this is how states and societies crumble.
We speak to the Tax Justice Network's Alex Cobham about the politics of counting and his new book, The Uncounted. We look at who's missing from the stats at the bottom and at the top. But first we're going to go to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, we're in the run-up to a general election in the United Kingdom. There's been a fascinating philosophical turning point. The current British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has decided, well, for now anyway, against his own party's plans to cut Britain's corporation tax, which they were going to cut from 19% to 17%. And he's been saying that he's going to put £6 billion into public services instead, which is pretty interesting turnaround. And obviously we're in an election cycle. This may be more of a postponement than a cancellation of this sort of costly and pointless race to the bottom policy we've been arguing against for years. But there are three really interesting things. I mean, firstly, they're recognising that cutting corporate taxes is a vote loser and that fair tax really matters to voters, perhaps more now than during the last election. Secondly, it's a huge argument being won here that corporate tax cuts cost us in lost services. And thirdly, this is a kind of admission, really, isn't it, that cutting taxes doesn't lead to economic growth, because if it did, why would the Conservative Party put at risk our economy by delaying this corporate tax cut?
Well, that's right. There is a mood shift happening, and not just in Britain. So the coming elections offer the, I think, the biggest opportunity for change since 1979, which was the year that ushered in the era of neoliberalism in the form of Thatcherism in the UK and Reaganism in the United States. So let's just talk a little bit about the signs of a mood shift in Britain and elsewhere. For those of you who didn't read the Financial Times on the 18th of September this year, you won't have seen an extraordinary front page wraparound, which is in bright yellow colours, five words printed in really large bold type across the page. And those words were, capitalism, time for a reset. Now, the Financial Times is the newspaper of the business and investor class, so this was a truly seismic front page. But I think it accurately conveys this sense that most of the radical reforms of the neoliberal era have failed to achieve the goals that were expected of them. And neoliberal capitalism in so many countries around the world is simply not delivering for the vast majority of people. For example, privatisation, which was a key part of it, that didn't lead to the necessary investments in energy, water and rail industries. Outsourcing services, especially health services and local government services, hasn't improved the quality of services, but it has led to lower wages for workers and large profits for the service providers, and I have to say excessive pay and bonuses for the chief executives. Financial deregulation in the 1980s set in train the behaviour in the banks and in the banking world, which inevitably led to the banking crash of 2008. So all the accumulated evidence of the past 40 years suggests that the big tax idea that both Reagan and Thatcher seized upon, which was that cutting taxes, the corporate income tax, and taxes on wealthy investors would stimulate additional investment and therefore grow the economy, and all the good stuff that would happen arose from those tax cuts, apart from the fact the good stuff just didn't happen. Instead, the tax cuts, by and large, they fed share price increases and ever larger bonuses for the company executives. So only a tiny percentage of the population prospered, and in some cases they became billionaires. Now, the public hasn't been blind to all of this, and most people have seen their wages decrease in value and the cost of living has risen, and they have seen the tax cuts for rich people matched by increases in the value-added tax rate, so they've been no better off from this. And since the financial crash of 2008, huge numbers of people across Europe have suffered from the welfare cuts imposed in the name of austerity, and they've watched the top 10% and especially the 1% and the billionaires walk away with huge gains from the quantitative easing programmes in Europe and America. And looming large over all of the social divisions is this existential threat posed by climate change, and this widespread sense that the business and political elites are still stuck in a business-as-usual mindset, going back to the early days of Thatcherism. So when Prime Minister Johnson postponed the promise made by his predecessor to cut the corporate income tax rate from 19 to 17%, this was a hugely symbolic moment, partly because he was forced to admit two things. The first admission was that the public simply didn't support the tax cut. They want $6 billion of tax expenditure, which is what the tax cut would have cost. They want that money spent on Britain's beloved National Health Service. Tax cuts were clearly a vote loser. But every bit as importantly, Prime Minister Johnson was implicitly acknowledging that the tax cuts don't boost investment and therefore don't boost the wider economy. And in practice, they serve no purpose other than to line the pockets of the billionaire class. So the ideas at the core of the Thatcher and Reagan revolutions, they've run their course and no one believes in them any longer.
Right, and we've had other arguments being won as well. I think we've had from the mainstream opposition party ideas about private versus state provision. They're talking about renationalisation. They're talking about making available free fibre optic broadband internet across the UK by 2030. Britain's market is currently delivering a terrible record on this. You know, so the point that private is not always best, the state can and should intervene in the public interest, and not intervening and not regulating is why we're ending up with monopolies and not genuine competition. They've also been advocating unitary taxation, which is something the Tax Justice Network's been advocating for years. So taxing UK-based multinationals on a unitary basis in a much fairer way, which would bring in a lot more tax revenue. So it begs the question, you know, whether this general election in Britain is going to be a 1945 moment or a 1979 moment. I mean, 1945 being the creation of a welfare state and all the social gains which have since been swallowed up by privatisation and outsourcing. And then 1979, obviously, the beginning of the Thatcherism era.
Well, I think you're right to identify those two. 1945, the end of World War II, Clement Attlee came in and you saw the creation of the welfare state. It was a massive shift, what they call a paradigm shift. And the same again in 1979, a paradigm shift in the direction of Thatcher and what became Thatcherism, a move towards neoliberalism. Well, neoliberalism is finished. It's a busted flush. I think that we're going to see a change, if not at this election, it's certainly coming. And I have the same sense, just coming back from the United States, have the same sense that they're expecting a massive change there. And the good news from our point of view is that the tax justice agenda will feature prominently in whatever comes next. More details about company ownership, more accounting detail about tax payments and so on, and a wider recognition, which I think we can see right the way across the world, that wealth and income distribution is clearly unfair. It's damaging our societies and our economies, and therefore wealth taxes and income taxes have a part to play in redistributing wealth more fairly. So I think there is going to be a massive sea change in the coming years.
Right, and let's cross the pond, and you've just come back from the United States. Talking of corporate tax cuts, we've seen some of the results of Trump's tax cuts. What have the results been there of that policy? Huge revenue losses, right?
Yes, so the Trump tax cuts were announced in autumn 2017, and since that time there's been no end of claims and counterclaims about how effective they've been. I've looked at a report published earlier this year by the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service, which is widely held to be politically objective and well-informed in its analysis. And the report addresses many of the issues raised by your question. First of all, did the tax cuts, which went from a nominal rate of 35% to 21%, pay for themselves through a sufficiently large economic growth stimulus to offset the revenue losses? Now, the answer, according to the Congressional Research Service, is that the cuts stimulated no more than 0.3% increase in national income in 2018, but a whopping 6.7% increase was needed to offset the revenue losses. So it didn't achieve anything like the economic boost that was expected. So that seems to be a resounding fail. Now, secondly, did the tax cuts feed through to higher pay for the rank and file workers? This is the so-called incidence argument, which I've always thought was cranky or outright deceptive. In other words, cut the corporate income taxes and it's the workers that benefit. Now, at the time, the Trump administration said the tax cuts would leave households anywhere between $4,000 to $9,000 richer over the longer term. Well, here the Congressional Research Service concludes, and I'm quoting this one, there is no indication of a surge in wages in 2018, either compared to history or relative to GDP growth. That's the conclusion of the Congressional Research Services. What did happen was a surge in bonus payments, which were one-off payments and most probably reflect the tight conditions of the employment market in the United States. So that brings us to the third matter raised by a question. Did investors, shareholders and the executive class do well from the tax cuts? According to the Congressional Research Service, a record-breaking $1 trillion was repatriated to the United States, not for investment in new machinery and new jobs and so on, but mostly to buy back shares. Shareholder dividends spiked upwards in the first quarter of 2018, immediately after the tax cuts were enacted, and investment in the productive economy remained at more or less the historical average rate. And that's it. So according to the most reliable source that I can think of, which is the Congressional Research Service, the most important restructuring of the United States tax system since the 1980s did almost nothing for the vast majority of working households, may even have reduced or eliminated gains by removing some of the personal exemptions that some of these households had, while the richest households have walked away with lower personal taxes and higher post-tax dividends.
That's pretty devastating. I'm just going to throw in something very interesting here as well, is that in the United States, if you compare the average income for the bottom 50%, in 1978, it was $17,500 per adult. And in 2018, $18,500 per adult. And that's figures from Gabriel Zucman, who we interviewed last month.
We need to address these claims that were made, particularly by the Trump administration, about the economic boost. And one final point. Overall tax revenue at federal level fell in 2018, largely because of a $40 billion fall in corporate income tax revenues. These are the tax cuts, these are the tax giveaways to the corporations and the investor class.
Thanks, John. John Christensen, the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. When it comes to fairness in the world, how well are we really counting it? That's not such a simple question, because counting is a very political thing. Because it's not only the most marginalised and disadvantaged people in the world who aren't being counted properly, it's also elites, criminals and their wealth off the radar too. So how's that skewing our understanding of the world we live in, and how can we count better? Here to talk to me about that is the Tax Justice Network's CEO, Alex Cobham, whose new book is out this month. It's called The Uncounted.
If we don't have good data, we end up taking bad decisions. When people go uncounted at the bottom, because they're marginalised, because they lack power, and for different reasons then are not included in household surveys or in censuses or in the voting roll, they lose votes, they lose public spending, they lose benefits, they lose inclusion, and they become further marginalised. People at the top who are able to skip out of being counted and go uncounted for the purposes of tax or regulation become more powerful in some sense. It is their excess power that allows them to go uncounted, and they move further outside what's been agreed in the social contract should be effectively the limit on inequality. And then, because the data is bad, we end up with much higher inequality in total than we can actually see, and much less good a basis to start taking policy actions against even the bit that we can see.
You say in the book that failure to count is a politically motivated thing. What did you mean by that?
Although this is a kind of whole set of technical issues, it's a political question. And it's the politics that matter. This can't be left to statisticians, much though I love statisticians, right? If we're not seeing this as a political problem that makes us face the hidden inequalities, we're not going to deal with it. We're not going to deal with the exclusion of women, of indigenous peoples, of people living with disabilities, especially learning disabilities, and ethno-linguistic marginalised groups, and so on. If we're not thinking about the systematic weaknesses in the data that we rely on, we're going to keep making those inequalities worse without even noticing it.
Okay, and there's a subtitle to your book as well, which is Power Inequalities and the Post-2015 Data Revolution. So what's the post-2015 data revolution? I think that applies to millennial development goals and sustainable development goals, right?
Right. So the Millennium Development Goals come off the back of the Millennium Declaration that all states in the world signed up to around 2000 to say, this is how we're going to make the world better over the next 15 years. Now, slightly unfairly, but not entirely, that's characterised often as a kind of donor agenda. This was about coordinating aid donors in order to improve some basic things around health and education and a few other bits and pieces. It was kind of a minimal human development agenda. So we care about extreme income poverty, we care about very basic education, we care about mortality rates, stuff beyond GDP, but not, in a sense, not too far beyond it. Whereas the Sustainable Development Goals, which came into force from 2016 and run to 2030, so the next 15 years, they're really quite a significant development from the MDGs. The Millennium Development Goals, and they apply to all countries at all income levels, not just recipients of aid, and they have this very clear focus on inequalities. Many of the targets can't be considered met at the national level unless they're also met for a whole set of marginalised groups. And what that means is that we need what's been called a data revolution. We need not just to have aggregate numbers on, say, the number of people living on less than a dollar a day, or the number of people missing from primary or secondary education. We need to know who those people are. Are they women? Are they marginalised ethno-linguistic groups? Are they people with disabilities? Are they Indigenous peoples? And so on. All of that means that for the first time there's this real concerted pressure to get that data to understand those inequalities. And this should be a real step forward. But it has been seen so far very much as a technical issue. It's just a question of putting the resources in to get this additional data. That's important, and it absolutely needs more resources, and the work being done on that is of huge significance for what we understand about the world we live in. But if we don't, alongside that, recognise that the problems in the data are not only technical, there are all sorts of political reasons why governments of one sort and another actively connive to keep people out of data. You know, you want an example from a rich country, we see the US today committing or trying to commit arguably the greatest act of uncounting of the present day, which is an attempt to strip out huge numbers of people from the voting rolls, firstly from the census and then from the voting rolls. In the census, it's by inserting a question on citizenship to make people afraid of answering any of the census questions. The effect of that will be that the areas that they live in, and these are people overwhelmingly who are immigrants and or from second, third generation immigrant families who will be most scared off by this, and the data is very clear on that, the areas they live in will then not get the same level of funding as they would have done. Those people may then find it harder or impossible to get on the voting roll, and so they also won't be able to express a preference. The effect of that, because of how those demographics break down, is that it's much more likely that the US has future governments that represent white, right-wing men in particular, the people who are most well-counted, if you like, and least likely to be afraid of a citizenship question. So it's a really deliberate effort to distort data in the biggest economy in the world. If you then think about everything from, you know, the Bashir regime in Sudan conniving to keep data about the regions that they were suppressing out of international statistical sources and away from their own citizens, you see very clearly how these things join up. We can't just see this as a technical question that we'll just work a bit harder and sort this data out. It's political, and if we miss that, we're going to keep missing the biggest inequalities.
That's quite challenging to get governments who are motivated in different ways to deal with that data in the way that you're suggesting.
Yeah, and you know, it's a whole set of cases. Look, it's very much tied to state legitimacy. One of the chapters, I start with a quote from a member of a Quilombola community in Brazil from 2010, saying, for the first time we're going to be included in the census, and now the government will have to listen to us. And there's this real sense of celebration that this remote community descended from runaway slaves is finally going to be part of the social contract. Right, so when a state, and this, you know, this is a Brazil under Lula, when a state is seen as legitimate, as intending to be inclusive, people are very strongly motivated to take part, to be counted. On the other hand, you know, whether you're thinking of groups like, say, Jews or Gypsies under the Nazi regime in Germany, or, unfortunately, many present-day echoes and equivalents of that, when the state is not legitimate, is not seen as seeking to be inclusive, people are actively motivated to go uncounted at the bottom of the distribution, because being counted makes you even more vulnerable than you already are. So, yeah, there's a whole set of questions there. But, of course, we also know from working on tax justice that when people at the top end are consistently able to go uncounted for tax purposes, it undermines tax compliance all the way through the system. If the rich, if the elites, if the big companies are obviously not meeting their fair share, not meeting their part of the social contract, why should I? And, you know, why should I be the only mug who pays tax? And it erodes all the way down. And this is how states and societies crumble. And I think we're seeing in some ways something in the US at the moment of this competitive erosion of the idea of the state starting to play out in the most open way under the Trump regime. But of course, also equivalently, you can see echoes of that in places from Brazil to Turkey, where you have both elites going uncounted at the top and oppressed groups of different sorts going uncounted at the bottom, or even trying to go uncounted. And these should be very clear warning signs to us, not just that we've got inequality we're not capturing, but that the idea of the state as a legitimate actor is itself in peril.
Yes. You often hear this no one left behind kind of slogan, and you talk about, well, what about let's leave no one ahead as well. Tell me a bit about that, because it's skewing it in both ways for very different reasons.
It is. And yeah, you know, the amount of wealth, perhaps 10% of world GDP, depending on the estimates we go with, and of course these numbers are uncounted by design, but held offshore, undeclared to home country tax authorities by individuals, sometimes the proceeds of crime, often simply the proceeds of business transactions, which then become criminal because they're hidden from tax authorities, along with the enormous amounts of profit shifting by multinational companies hidden through various secrecy jurisdictions in order to make sure that the country and the tax authority where those profits arose isn't able to count them for the purposes of taxing them. So we have a situation in which globalisation, running ahead of the ability and the coordination of nation states, has created this massive opening for people and money to go uncounted at the top end. And when you put that together with all of the uncounting we have at the bottom end, what you have is, you know, if you can imagine a graph with people lined up from left to right according to how much income they earn, the graph that we're looking at is missing a whole set of people with very low incomes on the left-hand side. And these aren't a random selection of people. As I say, these are, you know, people, overwhelmingly women, people from marginalised ethnic linguistic groups, people with disabilities, and so on, people at the intersections of various inequalities like that, who just aren't on our graph. They're just not there, but actually have lower income and would spread that graph further, make the inequality wider. And at the top end, more or less, we can see the people, but we're not seeing their incomes, and so the income bars at that end need to be much higher. It will be much bigger than what we can actually see. And so the measures that we think we're using to ask ourselves as societies, is this a level of inequality that we're comfortable with, are consistently skewed downwards. So we're agreeing to a level of inequality that's actually much higher than what we think because of what we can see, right? So that the politics of this, again, it's not the technical questions. We are not just leaving a load of people behind, we're also leaving a load of people ahead, and we're doing it without seeing it because we haven't challenged the politics of this counting problem.
Oh, so it's much worse than we think.
It is, but there's so much we can do.
Well, that's good, because that's what I was going to ask you about. Because all the rhetoric is always about we must lift people up out of poverty. You know, nobody's talking about we need to pull a few people down. Before we talk about what we can actually do about it, part of the problem in collecting this data is it's really expensive. And to actually make sure that this data is collected properly, assuming that there were governments there who were not politically motivated, not to do this data collection accurately, it's extremely expensive to do this properly. You do ask as well, who is counting the counters?
Right. The counting at the bottom, if you like, is not so expensive, particularly the kind of basic data that we don't have. You know, something like 1 billion people, a little bit more probably, but again, we're not sure, are uncounted from the moment they're born. Even their birth is not registered, right? So something like 1 in 7 of the population of the world. This isn't something that's terribly complex or expensive to do, but it does say there is something close to a non-functioning state in a large part of the world, or lots of different parts of the world, right? And this, we shouldn't see that as an attack on the state. We should see it as that we've drawn the line in the wrong place in terms of what is the minimum that we expect from the state. The minimum needs to start with that people are counted in order that they can be included. And, you know, the type of money that we spend on, you know, various grand aid projects, for example, is much more than we would need in order to have basic counting universally. But I'd also want to caution against doing that from the aid budget, because, you know, this stuff is political. We know that when statistics are funded by donors, they tend to serve donors' needs, which aren't necessarily bad needs, but they are not the same as the needs or the preferences of the population who are being counted. And in fact, another issue here is that far too much of our data is counted for the people providing the money, where they are not the people being counted. This, again, of course, is a reason to invest further in tax systems so that the people being counted are also the people who are paying for it, and therefore the counting is accountable to the counted. And this gives you, you know, a way into that question of to whom are the counters accountable. We need national statistical offices really operating at a consistently higher level, although there's an obvious resource question in a lot of lower-income countries. We see in a country like the UK, the National Statistics Office finding it increasingly difficult to do its work in certain areas because of cuts, but also the politics playing into that. It isn't neutral, right? And we're kidding ourselves if we think it's just about adding a bit of money and it'll all be right. You know, we at Tax Justice Network, as you know well, have for years fought this immensely powerful lobby of multinational companies and their professional advisors and the Big Four firms and others resisting the basic transparency of country-by-country reporting. You know, a simple requirement that, in effect, multinationals publish data about where their economic activity is, where their profits are, where their taxes are paid, pretty much to put them on a level playing field with a domestic business that's publishing its accounts, as most businesses do. Even that basic requirement for transparency has been repeatedly defeated by those lobbyists and continues to be up to today, although we are making rapid progress. Those going uncounted at the top have the power to stay uncounted, at least unless we mount a really direct challenge on it. And it starts with calling it out for what it is, but then we have to go further. You know, and that's one thing that I try and do in the book, is lay out a short manifesto of the kind of things that we need to be calling for and exploring and making, at the very least, making the people who would resist that transparency have to defend openly their preference for secrecy. At the minute, too often this happens under the radar. You know, it isn't even obvious who is demanding to go uncounted and getting away with it. We know the tools on the tax side to make sure incomes around the world are counted, even in the face of complexity and globalisation. These things aren't rocket science. The possibilities, the tools are all there. But we need the political will to put them in place to make them work. And to date, that hasn't happened, either for individual incomes or for multinational companies' profits. But it's there. At the level of particularly thinking about the uncounted at the bottom, you know, we rely, if you go looking for numbers, even basic numbers, how many people from indigenous populations are there around the world? Those numbers, you tend to find them in a UN report from 15 years ago, which in turn relies on a bit of academic work from a few years before that, which was an extrapolation based on a survey and a few other things. Right? The numbers are horrible. We don't even care enough about a whole set of marginalised groups to know how many people there are in those categories. This is basic stuff. But at the minute, there isn't even somewhere to go to say, this is the data we haven't got. Right. And only by doing that and starting to call out the governments who are ultimately responsible for making sure that data is part of their analysis and part of society's understanding of itself, the world we are, do we have a chance of building a baseline that we can see at least if things are getting better and start holding people to account for doing the counting, never mind reducing the inequalities. We'll get to the inequalities, but we've got to count people first.
Right, yeah, so there are challenges all the way across the board. The ones that the Tax Justice Network works on a lot and has found quite a few ways forward on things like public country-by-country reporting for multinationals, information exchange between nations, but those have really benefited the wealthier countries. The sort of access which the wealthier countries are benefiting from the OECD countries hasn't really been extended to poorer countries and less powerful countries in the world, and that's part of the uncounted problem as well.
It's a classic example of things being political, not technical. So we put on the table from back in the early 2000s these proposals for automatic exchange of tax information to effectively end banking secrecy, and for country-by-country reporting by multinationals to at least make profit shifting visible. Now, both of them, originally they were written off as completely utopian, but 10 years later, they were being required of the OECD by the G20 group of countries. And so you think, hooray, we've made it, right? But no, we haven't made it. Well, how does this play out? Well, we get automatic exchange of information, but only in a way that benefits effectively OECD members and some other large countries like members of the G20. Almost every other lower-income country is excluded from receiving that information on the basis of a set of hurdles built into the process to make it difficult for them to get access to that data. We'll have transparency, but only for us, thanks very much. Right? It wasn't just a technical solution that was required. It needed the political will and the accountability to make sure it was universal, not just for those in the rich countries club. Country-by-country reporting, the OECD adopted a standard which, although it is technically flawed, is quite close to the original proposal that we'd made, but only for the information to be made available to tax authorities in the home country, i.e. the OECD country of the multinational. Then we have information exchange arrangements so that who can get it? Oh, other OECD countries. Most lower-income countries still can't access this data, certainly not in a timely fashion to allow them to do a tax audit in year. So who's been empowered by our brilliant technical solutions? The rich countries who already had the power, who could have done this themselves if they'd wanted, right? Who hasn't been empowered? The countries who are losing most as a proportion of their tax revenues to these problems of evasion and avoidance. The political basis wasn't strong enough when the technical solutions got picked up, and so we're still left with this challenge. Potentially, these measures, which, we can say rightly are some kind of a triumph for the tax justice movement, may, as things stand today, actually have worsened the global inequalities in taxing rights because the politics remains so unequal. So there's always a political element, always a risk to it. And again, it's calling that out, being aware of it, is the first step to saying, where do we go? One thing we really need, that we're in the process of doing some work on now, is measures of the availability of that information to countries at different income levels in order to start being in a position to hold the OECD to account for the gross inequality of the approach that they've taken in these two areas.
So it's disproportionately an advantage to the wealthier countries, and that's all part of the importance of measuring illicit financial flows properly. That can be trade overpricing, underpricing, foreign direct investment, so-called, which is often only round-tripping, as well as the tax dodging and the bribery and the theft. Without that political commitment to poorer countries to give them that key access, they're in the dark. I mean, they can't count.
Right. And, the illicit flows target, the target to reduce illicit flows in the Sustainable Development Goals, is kind of a perfect example of this phenomenon going wrong. We have the African Union Economic Commission for Africa panel, chaired by Thabo Mbeki, 2013, 14, 15, delivers its report, and on the basis of the enormous momentum behind that about how much African countries are losing to different types of illicit flows, including profit shifting, the target is adopted to reduce illicit flows in the Sustainable Development Goals. Right. Hooray, great progress. What's happened since then? Well, two big things. Firstly, the US and the European Union countries, at pretty much every opportunity, have tried to unpick the definition of illicit flows to take out which element? The multinational profit-shifting element, because that's their companies benefiting from illicit flows. Then, and along with that, trying to block political progress in related areas. Secondly, there's been a complete failure to make progress on just technically the measurement of that target. So 5 years into a 15-year process, well, as we will be in January, there is no agreed indicator for that target, never mind any numbers. So is there any basis on which to hold countries, especially high-income countries that drive a lot of illicit flows, responsible for progress? No, nothing. And I think most of those countries would be quite happy if we hit 2030 without ever having a number. That's to say, with illicit flows continuing to go uncounted, right? And as long as the OECD countries, in effect, and some tax havens alongside, are able to block the political progress, the technical piece really doesn't matter. You know, we're still not going to get this counted, and we're not going to make progress.
So how to solve this myriad of problems? I mean, what do you propose as good ways forward?
What I try and put forward are a set of basic measures to bring us to a baseline of transparency about what is uncounted and how badly it is uncounted, and therefore how important that is for things that we think we know but don't, as well as things that we recognise we don't know but perhaps don't understand how important they are. I resisted, you know, writing down a set of data standards, because that on its own just can't do it. It cannot be the answer, a technical solution to a political problem. But the type of solutions that I'm talking about, or the type of options, include a lot of things embedded in the UN system. Not because the UN system is necessarily brilliantly functioning, or indeed currently very well resourced. Indeed, that's a real issue. But there is a political legitimacy there that you cannot hope for anywhere else. That doesn't mean it always delivers, but it gives you a chance. You put things at the OECD or anywhere else, you know from the kickoff there is no chance of them delivering a legitimate, inclusive outcome, even if the people involved want to. Nobody has got this right. You know, it's going to be a work in progress everywhere, but this is a wishful book, right? I'm not saying here's the answer, do it tomorrow and we'll be done, right? I'm saying let's at least be conscious of these issues and start building them into what we're doing in everything from thinking about counting to thinking about inequality. Big pieces of that, you can see you'd make progress quickly. GDP. Can we please get rid of GDP? Not just because it's a bad measure of economic activity, but because it's a distorted, biased measure, right? Consistently underplaying the role of women, but also a whole set of marginalised groups, in a way that means if we pursue higher GDP, we're pursuing a biased form of economic activity that deliberately underweights any benefit that there might be from marginalised groups taking part, right? We've built our entire approach to economic policy around a measure that deepens rather than alleviating those inequalities, those biases, and it beggars belief that, you know, so many years later, after these things have been identified, we're still doing it.
You've been listening to Alex Cobham of the Tax Justice Network. His book, The Uncounted, will be released by the end of this month, November 2019, by Polity Press. So much to do, and yet the United Nations now faces a funding crisis and is being undermined. It's all part of the political dimension Alex talked about. To check if your country has paid its 2019 contribution, check out the Tax Justice Network blog, The UN Runs Out of Money. And there you can also hear a short TaxCast extra of Alex on how the United Nations could be more sustainably funded and how it should stop pursuing private sector financing and partnerships. And you can hear occasional TaxCast extras like that if you sign up to our subscribers list by emailing me, Naomi, at taxjustice.net. And drop me a line and let me know what you think of the programme. That's it from the TaxCast for now. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.